and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is February 9th, 2023, and this is episode 365. And you are listening to Radio Warnerd, which you can subscribe to and get the newsletters and so on at patreon.com/Radio Warnerd. Anyway, I'm the co-host, Mark Ames, here in Rochester, New York, and I'm on the line with Gary Brecher, aka John Dolan, aka the Warnerd, in London. You're in London still now, right?
Well, I'm in London. I'm sick. You'll hear that my voice sounds messed up.
Sorry to hear that. First of all, I guess I don't know if you can, you know, say a few words. It sounds like the Radio Warnerd meetup at the Old White Bean / Bear was a success, right?
Yeah, it was a huge success. The room was jammed, and with a lot of people that I've known only from social media and met for the first time, really an eminent crowd. I was really impressed. The usual happened, that is, my feeble voice gave out after trying to shout above the noise for 45 minutes, and after that I was mostly pointing at my throat and shrugging.
Yeah, and now you're sick, so you have a good excuse anyway. But anyway, well, thanks to everybody for coming to that. I wish I was there. It sounded like it was blessed. Thank you to Amelia Lees for setting that up as well.
Definitely. Amelia lives near there. It's an amazing part of town. I'm in Hampstead, and it's really quiet. And there was there's a giant heath, as they call it, an open space right in the middle of town, and you can't even hear traffic there. It's amazing. Hmm.
So in other news, I went to see friends of the show, the TruAnon show in Toronto. They put me on the list, so I felt very VIP-ish. And it's actually a pretty close drive. It's an easy drive from Rochester. Actually, there used to be a ferry. But and I asked a bunch of people in Toronto when I was out there, you know, do you remember the ferry? Did you ever take it? Do you know anyone who took it? No one took the ferry from Toronto to Rochester. Everybody was going the other way. It was like a classic, you know, poor border city versus the rich other side of the border city. But anyways, so I drove out there and I got there, you know, I think the time that doors are supposed to open, and there was this huge line outside of this.
Wow.
It was called the Old Horseshoe Tavern, I think is what it was called. And like a huge line. I was like, oh my God, these guys are like, you know, I don't know, the Velvet Underground or something, you know, like some kind of big cult band or something. I hadn't seen that. It was hard to even fathom that for a podcast, you know, so many people would like line up. And I just got to say, I mean, I still feel very new to this podcasting. I know you and I, we're actually kind of old school, like compared to TruAnon, who we were going to do a show with, but for, you know, the damn COVID, we remember we had a show canceled. We were going to do a show with them. And I got to say that what they did, I would recommend anybody go see them. I think they still have some more shows. It was so great. It was amazing. It wasn't so much a podcast as like, I don't know, a performance, like a kind of comic performance, I guess. Really great, really cool. So I highly recommend anybody go see them. I think they have a few more shows left. I don't know, I'm trying to remember what they told me. Denver, Minneapolis, and somewhere else, Texas, somewhere in Texas. Should definitely go see them. It is great, really good.
They are clearly really talented, really funny people. And Brace, just from his images online, he has a great comic face, too.
He does. I mean, he has this kind of hunch slouch and this kind of wry, you know, smirk or something. But it's not an annoying smirk. It's a funny smirk. He's a funny guy. And they're both like, they're just, they work so well together as a team.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was great. And one other thing before we get to our interview, and we're going to have to call him up real quickly, but I just have to say this one thing before I forget that it happened. The other night, we were putting our son, our kids to bed, Sammy, who's 7, and Jerry, who's 3. And Sammy, when he's just an interesting kid. And as I was putting him to bed, he was looking closer at my hair. And he goes, "You're turning white. Your hair's turning white. You're dying on me. You're dying. Daddy, don't die on me. Don't." And he started bawling his head off. And then Jerry ran up and goes, "Daddy's dying. Daddy's dying." I was like, "No, I'm not dying." Kind of tried to make a joke. "You should have seen my hair before we had you." You know, and that made him cry louder. So we just had to explain, like, it's all okay. And I never felt so bad. I used to be scared of dying for myself. And that was like the first time I thought, wow, I'm going to feel really fucking bad if I die now. It's just,
I mean, I feel like putting apologies on my gravestone. It'll be like that. Like, sorry, I
let you down.
But, you know, you can fly me up there and I'll be happy to tell Sammy in detail how many other indignities await you before you actually reach the finish line.
Yeah. So much to look forward to. Mm. All right, let's get to our interview. We have a great interview with friend of the show, Ben Aris, founding editor of BNE and Telenews, to do a sort of beginning of the year roundup of the economic war related to the Russia-Ukraine war. Okay, we are very excited to have back with us friend of the show, previous Radio Warner guest, Ben Aris, the founding editor of BNE and Telenews. BNE stands for Business New Europe, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Initially, yeah. Ben is coming to us from Berlin, so he's perfectly situated for what we're going to discuss today, which we've discussed in the past with him, which is the economic war and the latest in pipeline or formerly pipeline politics. Just a quick roundup. Ben has appeared on Radio Warner. He appeared a few times last year. Episode 316 on the Russian gas pipelines and politics. That was just before the invasion that we all didn't think was actually going to happen, the full-scale invasion. Then shortly afterwards, episode 320 on the sanctions and economic warfare. And then in July of last year, episode 338, we sort of did an update on where the economic war was. So now Ben got in touch with me at the beginning of the year and said, you know, it's time to update. I mean, some things have gone as we thought, and a lot of things have gone differently than expected. So anyway, first of all, Ben, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Mark, it's a pleasure to be here.
And thanks for coming on. I mean, I want to dive into the economic war, but it's impossible not to first ask a little something about Seymour Hersh's big bombshell scoop from yesterday that the U.S., it's an amazing article, actually. It's not just the sort of, you know, the one takeaway, which is that the U.S. Planted and detonated the explosive devices that destroyed the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines, or part of Nord Stream 2, but also just the way he developed the whole story, that it was a plan that was developed going back to, to mid-2021 and was approved, you know, really even before, just before the war started, and then carried out, of course, after the war started. How is that story playing in Germany? I mean, I think everyone's actually bothered.
They're being careful. I actually haven't seen that much reaction to it. I think everyone's a bit cautious because, as you say, it's like political dynamite. Yeah. I mean, you think about what it means if it's true. And I should say before I go any further that, you know, A, Seymour Hersh is like, you know, class A, extremely famous, yes. Made his name, did the My Lai story. I mean, he's
Pulitzer's. Like, yeah, he did. I mean, he did the story on the CIA's illegal domestic spying program. He broke it using an anonymous source, broke it in late 1974, MH chaos, that led to the Church Committee hearings. He was savaged by all his press peers as a conspiracy theorist, as, not credible. They'd find a mistake. And then the Church Committee hearings happened and it was all completely validated.
Yeah. So, you have to take it really seriously coming from him. And on the other side of the coin is that this whole piece seems to be sourced on one anonymous source. And when you're dealing with conspiracy theories related to Russia, you know, I'm automatically very cautious.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, you have to take it seriously because if it's true and he has all the connects to get a story like this, then it's potentially extremely explosive because what it would mean is that you've got sovereign nation, US, who have been complaining about the Nord Stream 2 pipelines forever, saying they threaten European security. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is that, you know, it's European security that's threatened. So if anyone's going to blow these pipelines up, it should be Europe. And it's in no way, shape, or form anything to do with the States. And yet you've got, you know, whatever it is, special team, Navy special team, deep sea divers blowing these things up. Because the upside for the States is that without those two pipelines, then you've permanently captured the entire Russian share of the European gas market. You know, those two pipelines were sending all of the Russian gas to Germany particularly and then on to the rest of Europe. And that's a business worth hundreds of billions of dollars. And as a civilized nation, you can't do that. You can't go around blowing up, you know, your allies' major energy infrastructure resources to make money.
Yeah.
And it means that everything that the Putin's been saying about America, that it's, you know, is out to build a global hegemony to its own benefit, is true. So I think everybody, the editors, are sitting back and looking at this and like, it's just one autonomous source, anonymous source. And, you know, I'm going to be really careful with this because it's a real stick of TNT. I'm not sure.
But it's out there. You know what I mean? It's out there. So whether or not the you know, the mainstream media, very few out here have covered it too, or they've tried to denigrate it. Reuters called it a blog post, you know, like they're trying to kind of discredit it. But like the Times of the Times UK ran it with a pretty straight headline. It makes sense in some ways. It makes, you know, a lot of like real and harsh cynical sense. Yeah.
The economic argument that the US did it is extremely strong. I mean,
yeah, definitely.
If you start from the assumption that, you know, here you have the young US LNG market didn't export any gas in 2016. And now it's the world's largest exporter of LNG. But, you know, that market's dominated by, you know, the longstanding players like Qatar who have long-term contracts. And the U.S. is doing it on short-term spot market contracts.
Right.
Yeah, and they want to establish and do it. And, like, suddenly you have 30% of the EU entire gas market is up for grabs, you know, for the want of four explosions.
Yeah.
If you look at it from cynically from a business point of view, that's totally compelling. If you look at it from, like, you know, international relations, like values, whatever,
it's completely insane. It's insane because I know, because like I've had arguments with this back and forth, and I don't believe this anymore. But like when this very first happened, I thought, okay, I don't want to predict because that's like the first casualty of this war, and I ain't going to do that. But if I had a gun to my head and I had to place a bet, it would seem to me that, because it made no sense for either side really to do it because the downsides are so big. But I would guess Russia might be a little, it would make, the downsides for Russia are less than the downsides for the US and the West, because the US has everything already. When it set those charges off, assuming that's what happened, it already had Germany, you know, completely in our pocket, doing everything we wanted, already buying our gas, already saying, you know, Nord 2 is dead, already going with all the oil embargoes. Like, everything was already going our way. The only thing that could possibly screw that up would be if we went and blew up something in Germany and made them think, hey, wait a minute, who's our friend here? And we did it. But then, of course, that assumes that, which is another bad assumption of this war, that people are practical and don't do stupid things, and I think we've learned that they are not.
Well, if you want to wander a little bit deeper into the weeds, the argument that why the US would blow up their pipeline is that they don't trust Germany. Because Germany, all said and done, would actually, and I could easily see this happening, turn Nord Stream 2 back on again two or three years down the road. You know, the piece has been done in Donbass, and you know, there's a frozen conflict, and German industry here, I can tell you, has been screaming, pounding at the Chancellor's door, is like, stop this war. We want our cheap gas. We want to go back where we were. And the Americans could, you know, could argue, please didn't trust the Germans, and we're pretty sure they're going to turn it on as soon as they can. Because the way that Nord Stream 2 was stopped was that it was with the regulator for approval, because the pipeline had been built and even filled with the technical gas. It could literally have been turned on in 24 hours.
Right.
And what Scholz did is he removed a single document from the package at the regulators that made it impossible to approve it. But that mechanism, you can simply put that document back in the package. And again, within 24 hours, you get the gas back. But I don't know, it's conspiracy theories. I also heard a very credible theory from a friend of mine in Moscow that the pipelines were blown up by a freelance, independent team of Ukrainian patriots that hired a fish boat for 10 grand, bought some limpet mines on the black market in Zarapol, and did it themselves, which is also entirely plausible. So as I say, with these conspiracy theories, and we've had so many in Eastern Europe, and so often they've proved to be wrong, or at least simplistic, you know, characterizations, that you have to be careful. But now the story's out there, and like you say, the young hacks in Washington or wherever should be now running around. I mean, it's the whole, you know, the president's men story again. Once you start it, somebody else has to maybe finish it off. But still a fascinating story.
It's amazing. You know, real quickly, before we move on, a segue into what you just raised, which is something we really want to hear about, which is German industry. Do you know much about the actual story? Because I've had this sort of back and forth, I don't know, debate or whatever with some people. Like, because I would characterize the pipeline as, I mean, I know that it's either fully owned by Gazprom with a couple of, initially it was like a 50-50 or 51-49, but I think Nord 1 is maybe fully owned by Gazprom and some subsidiaries. So sort of de jure it's Russian, but de facto it's really German critical energy infrastructure. I mean, do Germans see it, or would have seen it, as a piece of, you know, critical energy infrastructure?
Absolutely.
De facto?
It's key. It's key. Yeah. I mean, that, you know, Germany is heavily dependent on Russian gas imports, and a whole bunch of industries are dependent on that gas, to the point where BASF, the huge chemical, petrochemical concern, has had to shut down or put on standby something like 100 of its factories across all of Europe. And the Schwedt refinery, which also is hooked into Druzhba and the Russian Soviet era oil industry, which is too far away from the coast to get to tanked oil. And so it's desperately been trying to find, and this produces, you know, for all of the petrol in Berlin comes from this one refinery, and like a lot of the refined products from northern Germany come from this one refinery. And there's been a workaround in the meantime whereby the Kazakhs are now sending oil to Schwedt via the Druzhba pipeline in some sort of deal. But then, you know, is that really Kazakh oil? To what extent is it mixed with Russian oil? You know, it's all suddenly got very murky. And you've got a lot of people here are sort of half pulling their hats over their eyes. And we'll probably talk about this later, because on the one hand, you know, you've got to do the right thing, stand with Ukraine. And on the other hand, you know, if there's no petrol in the gas stations in Berlin, you know, what's going to happen? You can't let that happen either. So it's already got
so have there been shortages? What's the level of anger?
No, and not level of anger in so much as, you know, we haven't got to that crisis stage where it's visible. What has happened is all the prices have gone up, and people are complaining about that. But we're still early enough in the process, and people are still sort of so ardently behind Ukraine because of the horrible, you know, brutal bloodshed that's going on down there, that everybody's willing to pay, you know, the tax, if you like, the solidarity tax. But slowly, slowly, you know, you can see the polls shifting. The far right, like the AfD, are starting to complain. Fringe groups, Russian emigre groups, are organizing thousand-strong protests. But it remains on the edge to the point where the government can and is ignoring it. But having said that, I say, again, I think Scholz the Chancellor is listening as much to the industry groups as he is to the people. And Germany's economy is one of the most affected in so much as everybody's looking at very anemic growth this year. Germany was expected to go into recession mm-hmm. in 2022 and scraped through with a 0.1% growth. Mm. But it's also, and this is the shocker for the Germans, I think this is what's really shook up the industry here, is that in May, for the first time in 30 years, Germany ran a trade deficit.
Right.
The export Meister, you know, has mm-hmm. suddenly fallen on its knees. And the industry is looking at it without this cheap gas. Then the whole thing is screwed because
right.
we used to take cheap energy, produce extremely high-quality widgets, and because we were the most powerful in a monetarized union, the euro, that the other weaker countries were holding down the value of the euro. So actually for us, the euro is undervalued. And this is actually a magical combination because then you right. have a cheap currency, you have cheap energy costs, you have extremely high quality products, and right. you just like export like mad. Right. And this has made Germany rich. And suddenly that whole formula has fallen to pieces.
Exactly.
And this is why they're so scared.
Yeah, you laid that out really well in previous episodes. And I've you know, never forgotten it. I mean, the whole German export economy, which is, you know, one of the great success stories in the world, as you just sort of described it again, is really in big, large part predicated on something that cannot be replaced, which is piped long-term contract, cheap Russian gas. You can't exchange that for spot LNG gas, which is what's happening now. Like, you can't build a mid long-term industry investment based on LNG spot market prices, right? You can only do that on long-term piped in gas. You know exactly how much gas is coming. You know exactly the price, exactly how long. And on top of it, the price is below market all this time. So it's perfect. And that's gone forever as far as Germany may, I guess now with the pipelines blown up, it is gone forever. Although, correct me if I'm wrong, Russia said they could fix. So it was Nord Stream 1 that was most damaged and 2 was partly damaged. But if I'm not mistaken, Russia said we could fix it in 6 to 12 months. I don't know if that's true or not.
I'm no expert. Look, I mean, 1 had 2 big holes out of the game for the moment. Nord Stream 2 is actually, there's 2 strands of the pipeline.
Right.
And one of them is fine. So you could
right.
pump a quarter of the previous 50 BCM capacity.
I see.
Could be turned on tomorrow. However, 2 is the one that is,
yes.
Nord Stream 2 is the one that is not certified.
Right.
So there's a problem there. But I mean, again, if you assume, like, you know, we're 2 years down the road and there's peace in Ukraine and everyone's going back to work, then in theory, you could get a quarter of that capacity working. I've also read that, you know, the corrosion from getting, you know, filling the whole pipeline with seawater is like very bad. But then,
right.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, technology is such that I'm sure if they wanted to fix it, they could. It must be possible. But, you know, you could get whatever it is. 12.5 BCM of gas flowing tomorrow, provided you certified the Nord Stream 2 part, which in itself is already significant because the only gas, I mean, that's more than's coming through Ukraine at the moment, and it's already as much as comes via Turkey. Turkey has, the Turk Stream pipeline is 30 BCM, of which Turkey takes half of that for its own consumption, and the rest goes to Europe. So you know, even, you know, 12.5 billion cubic meters would be significant, and it would be money. It would be more money for Gazprom. I mean, they would certainly do it. And then, how quickly you can fix the other 3 strands, I don't know, but presumably you can.
Mm-hmm. So tell us. I mean, look, the wars never go the way we expect them to. There are things that look, you know, reasonable to expect, but they never actually turn out quite the way you expect, including economic wars. You know, the economic war against Russia, the sanctions were described as sort of nuclear sanctions. I think Baerbock, is that the foreign minister's name, sort of publicly boasted that this was going to destroy Russia, and that was their intent. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, 10, 11 months ago, she was saying that. And everyone did expect that that would happen. And it turns out Russia has not been destroyed. Now, we have seen parts of their economy and industry suffer pretty catastrophic drops. But in terms of what the average Russian feels and sort of the macro picture, it's not nearly as bad. And as you said, sort of so far, at least with Germany, even though its economic model is broken, it hasn't sort of, it's like it's sort of in suspended animation or something. So what do you think happened? Why is Russia doing better than people thought? Or is that deceptive?
A complicated question. And it also depends a bit on what you think the goal was at the beginning as opposed to what it is now. I mean, briefly before we dive in, I mean, just on looking at the macro numbers that in February, March, when the first round of predictions came out of the extreme, and they were extreme sanctions that were imposed on Russia, what effect that would have, that the consensus was that would be a 15% economic contraction. To put that into context, 2008 was the last really big crisis Russia went through, and that produced an 8% contraction. So they thought this was going to be catastrophic, really, really bad. Russia just posted a 2.2% contraction for the end of last year, although there's a little bit about debate about that. It could actually be worse, 3%. But anyway, it's nowhere near 15%. Mm-hmm. And some people were saying it was going to be a 30% contraction. And to looking forward to 2023, I mean, this year, then the IMF just caused a bit of a controversy because it upgraded Russia's outlook for this year to say it's going to put in a 0.3% growth, which will be better than Germany, and it'll be even better than the UK, which is looking at 2.6 contraction. So here you have this massive, crushing, devastating sanctions regime that after a year, Russia's now growing faster than Germany and 3 points faster than the UK. So if you look at it just the macro numbers, then like the sanctions have been a complete failure. Mm-hmm. If you look at it in terms of the cash, then again, the sanctions were designed to gut Russia's revenue in order to make it impossible to fund its war machine. And von der Leyen was in the EU today with Zelensky giving a speech saying we've got a whole bunch of new, in the 10th package, a whole bunch of new like export bans that will make it impossible for Russia to fund its war machine. So in 2021, Russia had a current account surplus of $120 billion. That was an all-time high on the back of like tensions and oil prices and post-COVID rebound. The year that just finished, it put in a $220 billion current account surplus, twice the previous all-time record in cash, that the West seized $300 billion of central bank money at the right at the beginning, which was a real shock. Russia's made two-thirds of that money back in a single year, and it took eight years to build that money up, the $600 billion it had.
Wow.
So again, looking at it in terms of the cash, the sanctions have been a complete failure. And I think, and people being unclear about this now, I think when the initial round of sanctions came out in the first week of March, the idea was to crush Russia's economy, to make it impossible for the Kremlin to finance a war. And so we saw a whole range of obvious sanctions on various exports and what have you. But the two real surprises were the decision to cut Russia out of the SWIFT bank transfer. And that was discussed before in the build-up during the tensions rising. But it was like set it to be off the table because it was too extreme. And it was the very first thing they did. Mm. And the second sanction was to seize $300 billion of the central bank's money, which is half of Russia's entire reserves. And that had never been discussed. That came completely out of left field. And I think
ask a question about that, was there a legal justification for that? I mean, I don't understand how it happens. Like, I know this arose from me because we were in Trieste. There's a giant yacht called Yacht A in the harbor. It was just seized from some Russian oligarch. And I was just wondering, how do you do that?
It's easy. You just write the law. it's that simple. I mean, the thing with sanctions is that you know, there's a legal mechanism to say that you're in breach of international law, and we as a sovereign state decide to impose sanctions on you, and we can put special restrictions on anything we like. Which is, and there's a distinction there, because that $300 billion, so it's been sanctioned, so it's been frozen legally by the sovereign powers. However, it hasn't been seized. It technically still belongs to the Russian government. And you can't seize the money. You can't take possession of it, aka give it to the Ukrainians to fix their country, without declaring war on Russia. And so that's the problem, is that money is now stuck in a bank account, but the West can't use it. They can't give it to Russia, but the Russians can't get it back. So it's just sort of frozen in limbo. And that's what you can do with the laws. You can freeze things, you can tie them up, but you can't take possession of them, at least if it's not belongs to the sovereign.
So the basic move is just to say, this is an aggressive war, that's illegal, you are in breach of international law. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. And so we freeze your assets.
And their assets are assets are literally like, you know, $100 billion in this central bank, $50 billion in that foreign central bank. And so that's how they can freeze it, because de jure that like those assets exist in a Western country that is following the sanctions, right?
Okay. Yeah. And the sanctions give the central bank that's holding it the legal right to say, I can't send it back to you. But property rights are such that it belongs to the Russians. It's still Russian money. Okay. So you can't spend it. You can't do what you like with it. You can just not give it back.
Right. So Russia has this, you know, it's earning far more money than people had expected. And there seem to be all kinds of ways that they're able to get around sanctions, because it seems like, again, I think you talked about this in a previous episode with us, but the demand, it's not like the demand for oil and gas stopped. It's obviously still there, and people will always find a way to make money when there's a commodity like that, looking for markets. And so it seems that Russia has found a bunch of different ways to sell its oil and gas, including back to, in fact, what I saw an article about New York State, where I'm in, is essentially buying, I think it was Russian oil through some scheme. You know, it's always getting mixed somewhere else, so you can pretend it's not Russian, or it's moved from tanker to tanker, and then it's not like exactly Russian anymore, even though it is. Have you been following some of these schemes, or like what you just talked about? You know, it's Kazakh oil, but really, like, I've heard this with Azerbaijan. Russia will send Azerbaijan some oil or gas, and then Azerbaijan sends that same amount to the EU, and then the EU says, hey, we're just buying from Azerbaijan now, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, look, there are multiple leakages. And before I dive into this, I want to emphasize this is all happening at state level or top, you know, big business level. They're on the ground in Russia, the sanctions have been effective in so much as the operational problems, like, you know, farmers can't, most of Russia's seed potatoes are imported, really. It's a big potato producing country, but all the seed potatoes are imported. Same with the hatching eggs, they're all imported. And at that level, the operation level for lots of businesses, they have been, like, you know, very badly affected. But look, we're talking at now the federal level and the war level. And the thing with the oil business is there's been multiple sanctions. They've been trying to attack Russia through multiple ways. One favorite scheme is to ban oil tankers from moving Russian oil. And you can do that because they're all insured by Lloyd's of London, like 95%. And you have control over Lloyd's of London. And so you tell Lloyd's you can't insure them. And without insurance, tankers can't get into any port in the world. They have to have insurance. That's one scheme. And then Russians have come back with a whole bunch of other schemes of their own. So they have their own tankers. The central bank recapitalized the Russian insurance company that covers marine insurance and gave it effectively unlimited insurance. And so it means Russian tankers can now go to all the ports that aren't aligned with the US or the West. And we've got a Russian insurance. And so, you know, that's good. And they're like, everyone's like, yeah, that's good. India specifically accepts Russian insurance. And there's a huge trade that's opened up there. Yeah. And like you mentioned, ship-to-ship tanking. BP got caught out doing this in the Baltics. That it's got a refinery there. And it had, like, Russian oil. And what it was doing was putting 49% Russian oil in a tank and 51% Lithuanian oil in it, and calling it the Lithuanian blend.
I love how they actually went through the, you know, through the whole hell of just making sure it was 49.9%, but not over that 50% mark.
Like, it's that silly.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things I've been learning in the, recently is just like how notoriously unscrupulous oil traders are, that wherever they can make a margin, they will. They don't give a monkey's about Ukraine or values or whatever. They're just looking for their margin. And I think that this is the big point to take out of what's happening at the moment with the oil markets, is that these sanctions, and the EU have put in, on December 5th, they put in an embargo, a ban on importing Russian oil. Right. However, they match that with this oil price cap scheme, which says that you can buy Russian oil provided it costs less than $60, the cap. And what that means is that, so EU tankers and Greek tankers in particular, which are now carrying half of Russia's oil, which is an EU country, can do it as long as the price isn't higher than $60. And so if oil prices, and the Russians with the discount, their oil is cheaper than that. But it means that all of the oil that used to leave Russia and go to the EU, which is a sale of like 4 days, suddenly, in effect, can't go to EU ports anymore. So it's been sent halfway around the world to India and China. And there, India and China are refining it and then sending it back to Europe. So Europe is still buying Russian oil. India is selling vast amounts of its quote-unquote refined products to the US. And India imported no Russian oil 2 years ago, 1 year ago.
Right.
And now suddenly it's like the biggest buyer, second biggest buyer after China. All of the oil that used to go to the EU, has the crude oil, has been going to India and China where it's been refined and then sold to quote-unquote international markets. And who are the biggest buyers? It's the EU and the States. So what we're talking about here is not sanctions on Russian oil so that it can't sell it. We've just forced all the oil to suddenly make these massive round trips. So instead of sailing, you know, two or four days from Petersburg to Rostock in Germany to the refineries there, suddenly it's now got to go all the way down to Asia, where it's refined, and then all the way back again and be sold. And of course, all of the costs of that go into the price of oil, which sends everything up, and it just ends up being a tax.
And very un-green also for a Green Party to supporting.
Green goals have gone out the window.
Yeah,
And what you've created is a massive remake of the entire energy market, where the oil, and the irony of the oil price cap is one of the concerns of the EU was not to restrict the amount of oil going onto the market, not to take Russian oil off the market, because then that just causes an oil price crisis. And the price of gas would go. Goldman Sachs was saying, you know, the highest it's ever been is 145. And Goldman Sachs was saying, look, oil's going to $350, $400.
Right.
Which would itself spark a huge economic crisis. So there's all these conflicting interests here. And the EU itself, or the West, EU plus the US, have all these like conflicting concerns. It's like we need to get the money off the Russian budget, but at the same time, we need to keep oil flowing because we need to keep the prices down. And they came up with this scheme with the cap, which is like, we'll just artificially set the price at 60.
Yeah, how did they come up with 60 per barrel, I guess?
It's supposed to be the price where the Russian oil producers make enough profits that they won't shut down production, but that the Russian budget doesn't get much revenue from it. And pre-war, the break-even price for the Russian budget to not go into deficit was about $45, $42. Post-war, it's gone up. I've seen different estimates, 80, 105. 60 was supposed to be the price whereby the Russian oil companies could still stay in business and make a little bit of margin. But the budget, Russian budget, would make next to no money from the tax revenue it gets. So I think that's how they came to it. But then, you know, you talk to Poland and the Baltics, they were like, you know, we should set the cap at $35.
Right.
You know, really screw them. I mean, collapse the government, collapse the economy. And everyone else is like, nah, that won't work. You know, we'll just cause a crisis.
I mean, didn't they find early on when it looked like, before anybody knew how the energy markets were going to be remade, and it looked like there might be actual, you know, gas and oil flow serious problems. So then the price of everything went up, then inflation skyrocketed, and then there was all this talk of all we're doing is hurting ourselves. We need to find a way to hurt Russia and not ourselves. And it turns out that in a way, you can either only hurt Russia and yourself or not hurt Russia and not hurt yourself. But there's, I mean, at least so far, it doesn't seem like they're able to
find a way. Well, to be honest, the sanctions we've seen so far on the oil have been, we've hurt ourselves a lot, and Russia's made more money than it's ever made before in its life.
Right.
You know, and in that sense, it's completely backfired. And I think that another problem here, I think, with all these sanctions, well, look, I mean, to come back to the oil and gas sanctions and the very beginning, the sanctions, the central bank and the Swift bank sanctions were done in the first week. And that was supposed to crush Russia, bring it to its knees. And then it would have to stop the war because the economy would be going to melt down. Mm-hmm. What we didn't do and what we should have done is include the oil and gas in that first week. Had we done that, Russia's economy would have melted down. As it was, Nabulina, the governor of the central bank, was really struggling to keep the show on the road, but she did it. But had you taken away the oil and gas revenue, I'm pretty sure the Russian economy would have gone into meltdown. And then we would have been able, you know, then maybe we would have got our result that, you know, Russia, Putin would have been ousted, there would have been popular protests, the ruble would have gone through the roof, the banks would start collapsing.
But would the so-called West have had the power to do that, to make it stick with markets like India and China?
Well, at that point, India and China weren't importing any Russian oil.
Okay.
So the whole, and you have to understand, the whole Russian energy infrastructure, oil and gas both, 70%, 80% pointed to Europe. It's been tied together since the 70s. And there's virtually no pipelines going to the East. You know, a couple, but hardly any. And all we needed to do is say, all right, look, we're going to pay you your money because we're still importing gas, a lot of it, and oil, a lot of it. And it's your money, it's your gas, your property rights, fine. But then we can use these same sanction laws to say, but because you've broken international law, instead of sending you the money to Moscow in dollars, we're going to put it into an escrow account, which is still your money. And you can have that money out of escrow when you've stopped killing Ukrainians. And I don't see any legal reason why you couldn't do that, given that you seized $300 billion of central bank money. And then the Russia would have been cut off from all its cash, and Nabulina wouldn't have been able to cope with that, I'm sure. And the whole system would have gone into meltdown, and then you've got a situation where the Kremlin has to capitulate or stop the war or go into talks or whatever it is. But we didn't do that, and we've now put these oil sanctions in a year later, 11 months later.
By the way, just for listeners, Nabulina, Elvira Nabulina is the Russian central banker and one of the most highly regarded, at least in terms of orthodoxy and kind of management skills.
She's done an amazing job holding the whole show together, really. I mean, she's a veteran of multiple crises. If anybody's going to deal with like the start of a war, she's the one you want in charge because she really knows what she's doing. And we these oil sanctions, we come to it too late. And the Russians, I mean, it's quite fun to watch all the schemes that they're coming up with. Because
10th package, we're up to today, you know,
Well, they just talked about the 10th package today in Brussels. Yeah. And von der Leyen, the president of the EU, was talking about, are we going to put all of the more politicians on? And now we're going to go after the propagandists. So... what's her name? Margarita.
Simonyan and Solovyov. And
I mean, they're going to be sanctioned. And like, what difference does that make?
Exactly.
I mean, who cares? You know, it's like, and she talks about some export sanctions, but, you know, we've actually run out of sanction options. This oil package was the biggest thing they could do.
I remember at the beginning of the war, it seemed like everybody in the Western economics world was counting on the impossibility of shifting to an Asian market. Mm-hmm. Would it be fair to say that that's happened more easily than they thought it would?
It took 2 or 3 months to organize.
Wow.
And then all of the oil that used to go to the EU, 2 million barrels a day, has all been absorbed by India, China, the whole lot.
Wow.
So that completely failed. And now, since February 5th, we've got the oil products, the refined products, kerosene, diesel, what have you. And that's a bigger market, actually. I mean, there's like 3 or 4 million barrels a day of oil, of those products that are being exported. And it's much more widely distributed in Europe, because it was people like Hungary and Germany with big refineries that were taking most of the crude, which were hooked in to the old Druzhba Soviet era oil pipelines. Mm-hmm. The oil products, Russia has a big refining industry, and that's much more widely distributed. And so you can't send all of that to India or China again. It's too much. And they have their own refineries, which are now pumping out refined Russian crude as well. However, then that's where we are in the game at the moment, is like what to do with all of this kerosene and diesel. And so, for example, the exports of Russian diesel in October, November to Africa jumped significantly. Mm. And again, it's the same story. Senegal has suddenly become a massive importer of Russian diesel. It happens to have its own refineries. And so you're going to send, instead of sending that tanker full of diesel to Rostock, 2 days steam from Petersburg, it's going to go all the way down to West Africa. It's going to arrive at the ports in Senegal at the refinery. And then they're going to have standing on the quay barrels filled just above half full with Senegalese diesel.
Right.
Pour the Russian one in, put it back in the barrel, put it back on the ship, send it back to Europe.
Right.
Sounds like winemaking somehow.
Yeah. 51% Merlot. Yeah. Cabernet Franc. I seem to recall reading some stories about like how German trucking was really dependent on particular kind of, diesel mixture or something that really relies on Russian products. Yeah. And
Europe is a massive user of diesel. I think it's the biggest importer of diesel in the world. Yeah. Now diesel's more expensive than petrol. Which has never been. I mean, it's always been the other way around.
Exactly.
Because of the shortage and the dependency. I mean, even Ukraine is still importing Russian diesel because you can't get it anywhere else. Or you can, the Belarusians are another big source because they've got two big modern refineries. Right. So there's all these games, and then you've got the mixing, you've got the ship-to-ship transfers, you've got the people repackaging it. And if the products market can't be satisfied, and that actually looks likely, the analysts I've read that say, look, Russia's actually not going to be able to just scam away all of the production. So it's going to have to reduce production. But then that just leaves more crude, and so they'll export that instead. It's slightly less profitable, but... Anyway, the bottom line, I think, with all of this is that the oil sanctions that were supposed to be the crushing blow are not going to be the crushing blow that they thought. And the thing with the crude is that Russia can't weaponize it to the extent it's got too many allies, particularly India, China, that are dependent on imports of crude. But with the products... it can weaponize those. It can do things like just say, right, we're not exporting diesel. And then Europe suddenly in a real difficult bind. Where does it get its diesel from? Because, they're doing things
like... So that would hurt Europe more selectively in a way.
Yeah.
More than India.
Yeah, it's an option I've seen discussed. Again, I don't know how it would play out in the details. And the final thing we should mention while we're talking about this is that the whole... oil products market has suddenly gone dark. That you're looking at the analyst reports. I was just talking to Elena Rybakova from The Economist from IIF, who's doing a big report on this. And she was saying, I'm trying to work out what the discounts actually are because Russia has to offer discounts to get all these other people to buy it. And she said, I can't find any data. But suddenly everybody's clanned up. The traders are not reporting all of the deals with news agencies. They're not reporting anymore.
I've been wondering about that. It's nobody's interest really to report anything anymore, right?
There's this huge discounts and deals to be done. And the traders, they're all doing scams or whatever. Nobody wants to go out in the open anymore. And so the markets can't become dark. And so even things like basic things like what is the price of diesel on the market is now not known. I mean, not in the way it was before because there's so little data. And it's become very opaque, which is, again, to Russia's benefit. So it's all... And this is the real shocker of this. And I think this is the long-term problem that's going to come out of this. We've taken what is the world's largest and most efficient commodity markets, largest market of any kind, bar maybe the financial markets. And we've suddenly broken it to pieces. We've made it completely opaque. We've suddenly introduced these massive distortions whereby you have a product, a commodity oil, which has equal value wherever you are, and said you can't sail it 2 days down the road to sell it. You have to now sell it halfway around the world and halfway back again before you can sell it to the same people that you were selling it before. And now at prices that the market doesn't know what your price is because it's become a secret. This is an insane thing to do.
Well, I was wondering about next level insanity. For example, when do you go to blockade as with Germany during World War One? I mean, that would be...
But that can't happen.
That's war.
Blockade is an act of war. Blockade is an act of war, and the EU has fallen over backwards. I mean, this is why they're not sending the tanks and the planes that Ukraine's been asking for, because they're terrified. I mean, the whole Ukraine situation, the number one priority for the EU, the West, but particularly for the EU, is not to start a war with Russia. Mm. Number two is to make sure Ukraine doesn't lose the war.
Right.
And number three, Ukraine wins the war, is not even a war goal for the West, as far as I can see. That's not on the agenda. It's like, you know, if they win, that's great. But
it seems to be in Washington. I mean, I think it would be politically damaging if what came out could not be spun as an outright victory for Ukraine. But I imagine in Europe it's different. It's just more that Ukraine can't lose. I don't know.
Ukraine can't lose, and there has to be a negotiated settlement. And if you're going to ask me briefly about that, then my working hypothesis is that Europe is more terrified of going to war with Russia than anything else and will not do anything to risk that, including giving Ukraine the arms that it needs to actually win. They just give them enough to make sure it doesn't lose. And that here everyone's playing the waiting game because eventually so many people are going to die and the economy is going to be so smashed up. And hopefully with sanctions that would do so much pain to Russia that it'll also be willing to talk, which is the point of sanctions from the European point of view, that everyone will go to the negotiating table and there'll be a negotiated solution. And we'll end up with Donbass and the land bridge and Crimea remain, quote unquote, occupied by Russia. And it'll be a frozen conflict. And it'll turn into another North Cyprus. And I'm not sure your readers or listeners are aware of the whole North Cyprus situation.
Oh, we did a series on it.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. So then, so it's occupied by Turkey, active aggression. And now who gives a shit? Everyone's completely happy with that.
No. Yeah, well, in fact, going back to Afghanistan as a wound inflicted on the Soviet Union, you don't want... If you're the United States intelligence agencies, you don't want a quick Afghan victory. In fact, it turned out you really didn't want that. But you want something that keeps bleeding.
Or a peace. Yeah. I saw somewhere somebody was pointing out in 1983, there was the heads of Pakistan, I think whoever was the head of the UN, whoever was leaders, or I think Gromyko, foreign minister of the USSR. I mean, they had all gotten together. They had worked really hard over several months. They were actually very close to a peace deal, and the U.S. came in and said, we're not ready to stop this thing.
Well, that brings us to Naftali Bennett. What do you think about that story?
Well, as far as concerned, he just confirmed something that we already knew.
Yes.
So what happened here was that in April, March, in the first month, very quickly there were negotiations to try and stop the war. And that was at the point where everyone was still in shock and they couldn't believe the Russians were there. First round of people had been killed, rockets attacks on cities. But again, the Russians in the beginning were purposely targeting residential buildings in the outskirts of Kiev, for example, which were empty. So it was more psychological shock factor. So the stage had been set for peace talks. And they actually went pretty well. The Ukrainian side, Zelensky himself, offered to give up NATO aspirations and remove that aspiration from the constitution and return the country to a constitutional commitment to neutrality. And that everyone agreed that they'd put off the Crimea for future generations to argue about because it was too complicated. And that Zelensky was willing to go to Moscow, talk to Putin, and do some sort of special region status for Donbass. And this deal was nearly done. And then, and the key for that story was that I think it was the day after the Bucha massacre, you know, really awful slaughter of civilians in the outskirts of Kiev when the Russian troops were retreating. Yeah. And Zelensky was standing there in Bucha and was interviewed by the BBC. And he said, no, I'm continuing to think about this peace deal with Russia. You know, we've got to stop the killing. We've got to stop the war. And I'm still considering doing it. And then the next day or the day after, Boris Johnson flew into Kiev and said, like, if you do a peace deal, we won't support you. Mm-hmm. We withdraw our support. You can't do that. And then 2 days later, the Russians withdrew from the talks and the whole thing collapsed. And the blame, Ukrainska Pravda, this extremely highly respected investigative, they did the initial reports on that, that conversation. That. And what Bennett did, who's Israeli former prime minister, who was also acting as a back channel during that period and was fully informed and talking to the Russians as well, he came out on TV and just said, yeah, Johnson screwed it up. I mean, he boshed, put the kibosh on that whole deal. And that was it. That was peace. It was done. Kozak on the Russian side had also agreed and told Putin that you should do this deal. You need to end this war. Everybody was telling Putin, stop it. And Johnson's got the blame for killing it off. And I don't know what his motivation was. Personally, I have a very low opinion of him, and I personally think that he did it for selfish reasons, but I don't know. I don't follow English.
But I can't imagine he would have done that without consulting with the White House as well. I mean,
I don't think Johnson consults with anybody.
That's right. That is Boris.
He was in the middle of this Partygate scandal. He was about to and did lose his job.
Yep.
And, you know, he's a Tory, so he's looking at Thatcher and the Falklands War.
Yeah,
and she had the same thing. She was under political pressure. Right. She started a war in the Falklands for our strategic sheep purposes in the bottom of Argentina.
Yes.
And she won re-election. And I, as I say, I have a very low opinion of him. I don't know. I don't follow English politics. I think the worst. I think he just did it purely to save his own bacon.
Right. It certainly caused some kind of stir in mainstream journalist circles so that Bennett has now, as they say, walked it back. Like
He did somehow.
Yeah.
Well, Ukrainska Pravda came under extreme pressure from Vancouver, from the president's administration, and they walked back their story too. Yeah. Or at least, you know, toned it down a bit in a second piece. Yeah, no, I mean, this is an explosive topic. Same with von der Leyen. I mean, she said in a speech in the EU that Ukraine had 100,000 dead. Mm-hmm. And within soldiers. And within hours, Ukrainian foreign ministry was all over her and they took the video down. They deleted that section. They deleted that particular number because the Ukrainians say that state secret, how many dead we've got. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing to actually watch Bankova, the Ukrainian president's office, have that clout so that they can get the EU to censor a speech by the president of the EU to withdraw this number after it's out there. We've all heard it, you know? It's crazy.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about some other parts of the economy while we have you here. I've seen, I think from, it's Yelena Rybakova, right? That's her name. Mm-hmm. Some statistics on, for example, chips, high tech. We know that this is one of the areas that Russia almost invariably is going to suffer, but not maybe in the ways we expected. And she posted some reports, as I recall, that showed that chip imports actually rose in 2022 over 2021. And of course, China is now like the huge, its hugest seller. Turkey came in as well. So I don't know what you're hearing. I mean, I remember you had spoken
Estonia.
about Estonia, right.
The imports from Estonia soared off the scale, but they're still relatively small quantities.
Well, what does that mean? I mean, doesn't sometimes this mean the same thing as a bit sort of like with oil, where, well, if Estonia becomes a major exporter to Russia of chips, it means they're buying chips from a legal place or chips that Russia actually wants and finding a way around it?
The key here, and this is also a very complicated subject, because there's chips and there's chips.
Right.
And you've got the tiny, whatever they are, 9, 12 nano,
right.
Centimeter, nanometer chips, which are completely different from the ones you have in your mobile phone or even, you know, in your kids' toys. And there's a huge distinction between all of these. And so, yeah, look, the technology sanctions are by far the most biting and effective sanctions that the West has, and the West totally controls those chips. That there's no games Russia can play with that. If the West cuts it off from the highest quality, most complicated chips, Russia cannot replace them. There's nowhere it can go. However, of course, China and all those other countries have been producing chips. But they, you know, if you think of it in terms of a mobile phone versus like the old touch-style phones we had in the 70s, mm-hmm. is the difference in technology is like that. And so, mm-hmm. yes, chip imports from China have massively increased because now Russia cannot get those highest quality chips. And it's already started to diversify. I mean, Russia's been well aware of this problem for a while, for several years, for many years. Mm-hmm. And it's been looking to replace expensive German and US chips with cheaper options. And China has been trying to upgrade its technology to compete mm-hmm. with those, but it's still light years behind. And there's this key company, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturers, and they produce 75% of the world's best chips. Basically, all the chips come from there. And, you know, Samsung made a few, and America's got like one company that can compete, but they're
there's
basically
a Dutch, I'm thinking that that's the fabricator. The Dutch company has like the only fabricating machines to make these chips, right? Yeah.
It's incredible.
So these real bottlenecks. It's pretty incredible.
It's incredible. I mean, this is why the whole Taiwanese-China thing is such an issue, because if China invades Taiwan and takes over this factory, it suddenly controls 75% of the world's microchips. And the whole U.S. is screwed then, because they're not going to have enough. In fact, this company has just agreed to build its first ever $40 billion fab in Arizona.
Right.
And they at the U.S. quote-unquote insistence, according to the chairman, mm-hmm. because everyone suddenly realized that this is a huge security problem for everybody, is that you've got to diversify. And ironically, that it tried to build a smaller fab in the States before and found that the quality was half as good and the costs were twice as high. And so this is a very, very special place that makes these. But for Russia, it's a nightmare. To the point where the import of washing machines via Serbia and I think it's Kazakhstan have rocketed in the last 6 months because washing machines, funnily enough, have actually got quite sophisticated chips.
So that's not a total joke that Ukrainian social media likes to make a lot of jokes about Russians stealing washing machines, right?
The Russians, that's soldiers stealing washing machines to take them back to their wives.
Yeah.
What Russia's done is imported mass quantities of washing machines via the Central Asia or the Caucasus, Balkans. And then the chips in those washing machines have been turning up inside missiles that have been falling on Ukraine.
Wow.
This is where we've got to, you know. This is a huge problem. And I remember back in the 90s or the noughties when Russia had, Rosnano, they were trying to make chips. But then again, they had these bricks of a chip compared to the micro-thin.
Well, I remember Intel opened, maybe it was more R&D stuff. They were tapping more into the software side rather than the fabrication side. But a lot of big American tech companies had centers, some presence in Russia. But I guess they weren't manufacturing there, right, so much.
It's R&D. It's like Boeing. Boeing Aviation, they had one of their main R&D centers in Russia. The Russian scientists, fantastic, world class.
And the software engineers.
Physical
science,
software, same thing, world class. Yeah. Manufacturing of chips, that's something else. That's high-tech, highly specialized physical process. And so it doesn't matter how much brains you have. You have to have this practical knowledge mm-hmm. to build those factories. Mm-hmm. And Russia doesn't have that.
Can I ask about something that I think you said? I'm not sure. Estonia has exported more chips to Russia since the war started?
Yeah, isn't yes. that illegal?
Because Estonia is part of the Baltic Front, as far as I know, which is
yes.
intensely yes. warlike.
I got this from Elena as well, mm-hmm. that the numbers for chip exports from Estonia rocketed. And to be honest, I don't actually understand what's going on there. yeah. Something's going on. I don't actually know what it is. I asked our guy, Talon, to look into it because something right. weird is happening there.
Yeah, we should say a little bit about your publication again, B&E and Telenews, and we'll post links again to it. But it's a business publication, online publication that covers, it's grown a lot even since we talked, I think. You guys do a lot of, you now cover Africa as well, right?
Yeah.
And you seem to have a really good presence in Turkey. Maybe you've had it for a while, but you cover a lot of Turkey.
We have bureaus. Yeah. Our main bureaus are in Prague, Kazakhstan, Turkey, Moscow, Kiev, where else? In southern, in the Balkans, we have people in nearly every country. Mm-hmm. Uzbekistan, we now put a lot of effort into that. And then we expand, we cover all of Africa. We've got 10 correspondents down there now.
That's great.
And we're going to do, we already do energy for Latin America, but we're going to expand in the second quarter of this year to do business, economics, finance, and politics of all of the Latin American countries too. So that gives us most. We're basically EM. We're emerging markets. Right. The only one we're missing is Asia, and we do energy in Asia. We have correspondents there doing oil and gas. I'm looking at how to do general news, business news, but it's kind of well covered. So we're looking for partners there.
Right.
We have to do it with a partner.
Right. So and then getting back again to Europe a bit, I mean, you know, Europe also, though its economy hasn't collapsed yet, it's in this weird, suspended animation place. But it also is looking at serious long-term problems, right? Because without the piped Russian gas, the engine of Europe's economy, that is Germany, I mean, how is it ever going to get going again the way it had up until February 2022. You talked about BASF, for example. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's the outlook? You talked about BASF already shuttering 100 factories all around and refineries and stuff around Europe. I mean, is that in other industries as well? Are you seeing more of that, or are they adjusting?
They're adjusting. I must say that given that the EU is basically a herd of cats, you know, half of which don't like each other, that Brussels has done really an amazing job of dealing with this crisis. It's done that largely by throwing lots and lots of money at it, but it's been really pretty effective. And the thing with the energy crisis that should have been has been pretty much totally avoided because, I mean, the Russians, normally they pipe about 150, 155 BCM of gas to Europe, and last year they only did 60 in the first half of the year and then cut Europe off the rest of the year. And in theory, at the beginning of the year, we're saying, look, there's not enough LNG in the world in order to replace Russian gas. Mm-hmm. And what they did is they hobbled together a system where they did replace it and ordered masses of LNG where there happened to be a surplus because China was doing so badly, which was a bit of luck.
Right.
But then other things, you know, they did subsidies, they dealt with inflation, the central banks, you know, making cuts. And it's all, the whole of Europe has actually come through in much better shape than it should have done. And now we're going into the new year and there's a huge push to build renewables. More renewables came online last year than ever before. And the challenge to, and that's the solution to this gas Russian problem, is renewables. And the studies I've seen means you're going to have to triple investment into it. But actually, the form that Europe's shown in the last year is that's actually conceivable and more than possible. Really? It's probably going to happen. Huh. They're pouring money into it, and it's accelerated the whole green revolution in a really positive way. And people are looking at other alternatives like geothermal, which is actually, that's a great one because that's not dinonorial. That doesn't depend on the sun or the wind. It's like you're tapping in its core for geothermal heat. And so that's another direction people are going into. And all the energy savings and the consumption savings, that von der Leyen came up with this plan to force everyone to cut gas consumption by 15%. And everybody told her to get knotted and that they weren't going to be forced to do anything. But then it happened. It was cut by 15%. Everyone did it.
You got lucky with a mild... I'm sorry to cut you off. You got lucky with a mild winter, too.
Absolutely.
We don't have any snow here in Rochester. I mean, it depends where you are in the world, but... Here in Rochester, the snowiest city in America, no snow.
Mild winters are a good bet now.
Yeah.
It's going to go that way. But it could have, I mean, when you think of, I'm just thinking of Naipaul writing about Trinidad during World War II. This could be a great thing for Senegal and places that don't normally figure in these petrochemical tables.
Well, there's in Nigeria, there's a massive gas field. And for 20 years, they've talked about building a pipeline to Europe. That pipeline will probably appear this year.
Oh. Wow.
And it's been going, and that's a 30 BCM pipeline. I mean, that's sort of a third or fourth, a quarter of the missing Russian gas. And other pipelines from Morocco. I mean, you know, Africa actually is going to be a huge winner from all of this. Because suddenly it's in a playland the way it was. And it's the same with Senegal. I mean, Senegal... If you want to put some money into an emerging market, I'd look at Senegal because they've built this huge oil and gas industry. And then suddenly there's this ginormous demand. And they get extra cash by, quote, unquote, re-refining, you know, Russian diesel. You know, we just launched in Africa and I'm sort of tapping myself on the back, the luck we've had with the timing of it, because we would be writing about Africa as a European publication anyway at this point. In the sense that it's now in play in our story in the way it's never been before. And we've been doing this 15, 16 years, and Africa's never been a thing. And suddenly it's like increasingly, you know, getting European writers to write about African stories, like this pipeline that's going to come across, and I think it enters in Europe, in Italy, is going to be the landfall for that one.
Right. Can you talk briefly about Africa's view of this war? Because generally what we hear is, those Africans, they don't get it. They're not coming on board. They're being hoodwinked by those sneaky Russians into thinking this is an anti-colonial or anti-imperial war or whatever. But it sounds like there's a lot of practical, pragmatic self-interest going on, as well as, I don't know, just a desire not to get caught up in a, you know, European war or something. Can you explain
it? We asked our staff in Northern Africa to do a wrap. Of the attitudes of governments, policies towards. And what came out of it was that the colonial thing is still very strong.
It is.
And you've had Schultz and you've had Macron and you've had Erdogan have been touring, looking for deals, trade. And Blinken has been traveling there as well, trying to get people on board, you know, our side. And really, they're not interested, the Africans. They're like, no, this is like, it's the Europeans, it's the white people fighting amongst themselves, and this has nothing to do with us. And we're just here, like, we've got so many problems, you know, feeding our people, like getting fertilizer to put into the fields, building the infrastructure, building schools, hospitals, that we just can't be bothered. We're not going to get involved. And suddenly the Russians are turning up on our door and offering us all this cheap grain and fertilizers and oil, and like, yeah, we're just going to buy it.
That's what I was going to ask. So the Russians have been...
Yeah,
kind of reviving actively old relationships and
well, they always
giving
had
them something. Right.
They've always had those. Because in the Soviet days, I mean, this is another reason why they're so well received, because in the Soviet days, the Soviet Union saw the black African workers as brethren.
Right.
And you remember being in Moscow. I mean, those universities are full of African students. You know, they're millions.
People's University and all that,
exactly. And so, you know, there's long, deep relationships. So it's been easy for Lavrov to go around and revive all of those, because he comes with a basket full of goodies now as well.
Right.
It's like, we can sell you oil at 20% discount. And the Africans, yeah, bring it on. But I thought Tellingly, there was the first Africa-Russian summit that happened in 2019 in St. Petersburg. And the Kremlin had already focused, had already begun this process of like moving closer and offering goodies to people long before this war happened, long before the showdown with Europe started, which was started from February 2020. Mm-hmm. And to that conference, 49 of the 54 presidents of Africa turned up. Wow. Everybody. And so, and they made a big song and dance, and the Russians offered a lot, and everyone was super interested because they're like, Russians, what do they bring? They bring commodities, but they bring weapons, advanced weapon, which we want, and they bring nuclear power stations, which we want. There's now two nuclear power stations are being built now, and there's at least another two firm commitments and another six under discussion.
In Africa.
And in Africa, built by Russians who have world-class nuclear power technology.
Right.
And, you know, that's an irresistible offer. The Americans, belatedly, having ignored Africa, they don't even have any military bases there apart from Djibouti, held their first Africa summit in Washington. And they've just set up a $600 billion quote-unquote investment infrastructure fund for Africa. And again, 42 of the leaders turned up to that in Washington in December. But Blinken was asking the South Africans to stop being so nice to the Russians, doing all these deals. And South Africa is one of the ones with the nuclear power station.
Right.
And they were just like, nah, look, sorry, mate, you know. You white people go and sort it out between yourself. You know, just leave us alone. We're busy trying to deal with our power crisis, which they have.
Right.
You know, the global south, you know, of course, these not rich countries, but that's Putin's bet, is that, you know, all right, I'm just not going to do business with the West. The global south, put it this way, the sanctions and the fight at the moment, two-thirds of the world, counted in terms of per capita GDP, is against Russia. Two-thirds of the world, counted in terms of just population, is either neutral or for Russia. Mm-hmm. And that's how it breaks up, you know. It's the rich countries against Russia, the poor countries, global south, down into Latin America, which are very much on Russia's side, all are neutral or support Russia, and certainly will do business with it. And the Russians are happy with that. You know, you don't have to support us politically. Let's just do business.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's how it works. We're fine.
Well, I would think economies like India and China, per capita, perhaps they're not rich, but they amount to a great deal.
Right? Huge markets. Yeah.
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 Well, this is the interesting question we're starting to look at. It's like, what's more important, cash or people?
Yeah.
2 billion people or 300 million with 30,000 a year income?
Right.
And Putin has been forced into it, or chose, the, you know, I'm going to go with the large populations. Because the other thing is, that's where all the growth is.
Yeah.
All the growth in the world is coming from the EMs. And, you know, Germany, we're in stagnation. We've got a population replacement rate 1.2. It's worse than Russia. Mm. And that's pretty much true across all of Europe. I think the States is, still has one of the few countries with growing population. But it's only 300 million.
Well, there's been a lot of anxiety over that because it, I think it finally dipped below replacement level or something. And from Elon Musk on down, they've been starting to screech about it.
Yeah. Right. So it looks like if we look at the economic war, that it's turned into more or less of, at least for now, looking at it now, it appears to be more or less like kind of a stalemate, that it wasn't as apocalyptic for either side. It didn't go as people expected. It is damaging. It is forcing, you know, restructuring of markets and economies, but so far it's essentially kind of stalemate, kind of like the war in a sense. What do you hear about from there in Berlin? And then we'll let you go because we've kept you on along. But what are you hearing about where the war is right now? I mean, the way I see it, people are so bipolar. Like, one minute it's like, oh my God, Russia's going to take over everything. Then it's, Russia's a joke. Ha ha ha. You know, now the only question is not whether Ukraine takes back Crimea and the Donbass, but should it march on to Moscow and then back to, oh my God, it's all over.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, so, it's very emotional.
Yeah.
I was just asked to do a study based on the question of, like, when will the war end and how can that happen? Mm-hmm. So I've been trolling through our reports and got our guys to look at it too. And I've come to the opinion that, look, at the moment, clearly the war is in a stalemate, that there's no advances being made in either direction, that after the Kharkiv and Kherson offenses in September, where Ukraine caught Russians out, mm-hmm. this beautiful feint in Kherson, mm-hmm. which put the Russians put all their best troops in there, and then they attacked Kharkiv, which was thinly defended, and so mm-hmm. took back masses of territory. But then you had the mobilization, you had Sorokin come in, the new general. He withdrew from Kherson, which was untenable because it was the wrong side of the river and couldn't be supported. Mm-hmm. And then what happened was the troops from there plus the conscripts stabilized the line. He's got a shorter defensive line now yeah. with much bigger intensity of defenders. He stopped attacking people. The only attacks going on in Bakhmut at the moment in Donbass, but that's exclusively Wagner that's doing that. It's not regular Russia troops that are doing that. And so they're starting to be careful with their men. And he's dug in. And the way I see it is that he's stabilized the line and they're basically buying time now until the spring comes. And in that time, of the 300,000 that they brought in conscripts, half of them have been moved up to the front and been told to defend because they're poor quality. They can't attack anything.
Right.
But there are guys who sit in a foxhole with a gun, which you have to get past so they can defend. It also gives you the possibility to rotate the troops, that you've got half in reserve and half at the front, and that keeps them fresh, which was a problem before. Whereas the Ukrainians don't have that opportunity. I mean, the guys in the front line in Bakhmut are just fighting nonstop because they don't have those reserves. And I think the plan here is to wait, give industry the chance to resupply the army, to go into industrial production of shells and the missing armaments that the Russians need. And then they'll launch a major offensive in the spring, sometime in March, and try and retake or take control of the whole of the Donbass region. And I think at that point, Putin will stop. That the rest, you know, taking the rest of the country is just not feasible. They've shown themselves to be incapable. And then if he takes the whole of the Donbass, then he can say, look, mission accomplished. We were there to save the Russian ethnic population in that region who were being slaughtered by Nazis, and he can declare victory and then freeze the conflict there. And I think he'll be satisfied with that. And if he does do that, I'm not sure if the Ukrainians have much choice. They can continue fighting, but I actually get a very strong impression that everyone, particularly in Europe, would be happy to see this stop. Mm-hmm. And they'll go with that.
I keep hearing that among the sort of industrial business, you know, elites or whatever you call them, that they just want this war to end in some way, but they just don't. I mean, they don't have the power, and I don't think DC still as far. Although you're starting to see a little cracks in from sort of the DC punditocracy, little hints of things dropping in big newspapers here about, you know, maybe this should end with a negotiated settlement after all.
DC is leading. Yes. I don't think the Americans mind either way. I mean, they've got nothing to lose. In fact, the longer the war goes on, the weaker Russia becomes as far as they're concerned.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they don't care if it's a long war or a short war.
Exactly.
In Europe, it's different. And I think if Europe, particularly led by Germany, where it's clear that they would accept a peace as soon as one is possible. But in Europe, I think if Europe wanted a peace, if it was on the cards, Putin came and said, I'm going to freeze it here, that America would have to follow suit then. Because the logistics of the operations of getting all that stuff into Ukraine has to come through Poland or what have you. And if Europe... I don't know. It's complicated. I mean, the Poles could go off on their own. I mean, God knows what would happen. But my working hypothesis is that this will drag on all year, that this season until next autumn will continue to fight because the Ukrainians are not going to give up.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, for the Beltway elite in D.C., the war is already won. NATO is reinvigorated. The defense budget is reinvigorated. All those 20th century alignments that they were so nostalgic for have come back like vegetation in spring. So they're happy, I think.
But I want to go on record and say that having looked at it hard now and given the increasing problems with logistics and particularly ammunition supply to the Ukrainians and what we're seeing, we have a guy in Bakhmut at the moment and saying that people are exhausted, you know, psychologically run down, not getting anywhere, being pushed back. And I think this is a Russian plan. It's just simply to wear them down. And Russia has three times the people. People keep skipping over this. It's very important that Ukraine has to kill. They're killing 1-to-1 at the moment. But Ukraine not only could kill 2-to-1, and actually that would improve Russia's hand because Ukraine's going to run out of people before Russia does. And Russia's about to pour in a lot more people. And it's just going to wear them down. And so I think there's actually we should start talking about very real possibility that Ukraine loses this war this summer.
Okay.
That they just throw, you know, 500,000 more people into it. I mean, lose it in the sense that they lose control of all of Donbass.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I think Putin has the option of freezing it, which I think this is a very likely scenario. I think most likely it's just going to drag on all year with another 100, 200,000 people.
That's what I think. These wars tend to go on longer than what is reasonable, you know, and even if a ceasefire happens, they get broken pretty quickly. It seems like politically this war has more juice left in it.
And the West will continue scaling up the power of the arms that they send in to make sure Ukraine doesn't lose. So I think most likely it's just going to have another season. And then when we get to autumn next year, at that point, some people are going to start arguing, look, this is not winnable.
Right.
We throw them everything. We've given them F-16s. We've given them HIMARS. We've given them tanks. And it's made no difference. It's not winnable. We have to do a peace. But I think we have to get to next autumn. The one coming. Until people even start thinking like that.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And that assumes that there isn't some surprising level of, you know, I don't know, some big surprise in the war movement. But going by the way it has been going, that sounds pretty reasonable, I think. Yeah.
Isn't that what they say about wars? The longer they go on, the more unpredictable they become.
Yeah.
And it seems
And how after Ukrainians, they're absolute heroes. I mean, I think, you know, it's going to be one of those like epic things that's going to turn into some magical movie where you've got a team of Ukrainians driving like 5 Abrahams and 2 Challengers like over the hill and blast the Russian commander out and the whole thing falls to pieces. You know, that kind of scenario is absolutely on the cards as well. I mean, they've shown themselves to be absolute classic Hollywood movie type heroes. So who knows?
They definitely surprised the Kremlin with their fighting a lot. Yeah. But that's why I also think it's so hard for me to imagine that Ukraine would agree to a ceasefire. I mean, they are, the culture of war there is not one of let's do a deal. It might have been possible in that first month or two, but
it very nearly happened. It was April it got killed. But since then, I mean, you listen to the Ukrainian terms now, it's like, right, we won't even start talking to you about the possibility of peace until you've left Ukraine completely and withdrawn, or, you know, so basically you've been defeated. Then we'll talk about peace.
It's going to have to come from Brussels and Washington, basically. On that grim note, but we're gonna want to stay in touch with you as well, and you know, follow the progress of the economic war, and how it's affecting. And you have such great global reach with PNE and Telenews. Anyway, thanks again for joining us and updating us on what's going on.
Thanks very much,
Ben Aris. It was a great pleasure always.
Ben Aris, founding editor of PNE and Telenews. Okay, and I think we can end the episode here. Thanks again, everyone, and John and Brendan. And thanks again to Ben for joining us, spending the time talking with us, and talk to you again soon.
Bye.